Greetings and welcome to Mind Matters News. I'm your not dead yet host, Robert J. Marks. We're talking today to Michael Ignor, a medical doctor and a neurosurgeon. He's a professor of neurosurgery and pediatrics at State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's an award-winning brain surgeon. He was named one of New York's best doctors by the New York Magazine in 2005. And he's the co-author of a book that I highly recommend, especially if you're interested in the things that we're talking about in the sequence of podcasts. The name of the book is The Immortal Mind. The Immortal Mind. It's co-authored with Denise O'Leary, a science writer, and the full name of the book is The Immortal Mind, A Neurosurgeon's Case for the Existence of the Soul. So if you've joined us in the past, you know that we've had a lot of really stimulating discussions. So get ready for another fascinating conversation with Dr. Ignor about the mystery of you, the mystery of you from the perspective of a neurosurgeon who's actually been and in and touched the brain, as we talked about last time. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, Bob.
Let's talk about near-death experiences. That's something that you and I have both studied, and you have it from a closer perspective. Kind of give us an overview of what near-death experiences are and what do they suggest about consciousness and the immortality of the soul.
Yes, near-death experiences are a subset of spiritual experiences that people have been having for thousands of years. There's a very large literature on it. There are actually scientific journals devoted to studying near-death experiences. And they become particularly common and particularly widely publicized over the last half century or so, in large part because many more people are surviving cardiac arrest and things that previously would have led to death. So people come back and tell us what happened during a period of time when their heart had stopped and their brain wasn't functioning. And it's a fascinating field. There have undoubtedly been tens of millions, at least, of near-death experiences in human history. And there are many thousands that have been reported in modern times. And about 20% of them are what are called veridical experiences, meaning that there's some aspect of the experience that can be checked and that demonstrates that the experience is real. So this is a real science, and there are people studying it scientifically.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'm confessing my ignorance, but I had to look up the word veridical. Could you define it? What does veridical mean?
I have to confess, I had to look it up too. I believe, as I understand, and I use the word veridical because it's in the literature. People refer to them as veridical experiences, and it just means experiences that can be checked, and you don't just have to take the person's word for it.
Ah, okay.
For example, somebody says, during my near-death experience, I encountered my cousin Joe on the other side of the tunnel, who was in heaven. And as it turns out, maybe Joe had just died, and the person who had the near-death experience didn't even know he was dead, but saw him in heaven. So it's some fact about the real world that you can check and confirm that something very unusual happened.
Very good. Okay. Now, my understanding, there's kind of two types of near-death experiences. There's one which is an out-of-body experience, if you will, that you're actually present and you can actually during the time that you're brain dead and heart dead, your body is dead, your brain is dead, you can actually look around the room and you can see things. And I think some of these are veridical because some of these patients come back and tell the surgeon things like, you didn't use very nice language while you were operating on me. Or one account I read said that the surgeon came in and didn't wear chaps.
Yes.
Which I guess you're supposed to wear those. Do you wear chaps when you do surgery?
Chaps, meaning like
oh yeah, covering of the shoes.
You don't have to. If you have to wear shoe covers if the shoes you're wearing in the operating room are shoes that you sometimes wear outside of the operating room. If you have special operating room shoes, you don't have to wear a shoe cover.
Okay. So anyway, these are some of the veridical sort of things. I mean, these people were brain dead, body dead, and they could tell things which were happening in the operating room and even external to the operating room. And then there is the second type of near-death experiences. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but the second type is when you kind of visit what my friend Walter Bradley calls the front porch of heaven, where you encounter people that, for example, have passed away, relatives and old friends and things of that sort. So there's two dimensions to the near-death experience. Do you agree with me? Do I got it right?
Yes, yes. And it's not uncommon that people have both, that people have an experience of being out of the body and then they encounter a tunnel and go into the tunnel. So sometimes it's one or the other and sometimes it's both. Probably the most famous both experience and probably the most famous modern near-death experience is that of Pam Reynolds. And Pam Reynolds was a woman who in her mid-30s began having headaches, and she had an MRI scan, and it showed that she had a huge aneurysm at the base of her brain and involving the most critical artery at the base of her brain. And it was a kind of an aneurysm that was considered inoperable because repairing it was so complex and it was such a delicate area that she would never survive the surgery. She went to a neurosurgeon in Phoenix named Robert Spetzler, who was sort of the world's expert on aneurysm surgery. And Dr. Spetzler proposed a radical operation on her aneurysm. What he needed was about 30 minutes to fix the aneurysm with no blood flowing through it. Because he had to basically take the artery apart and rebuild it. You couldn't do that with blood flowing through it. And it was a part of your brain where you couldn't just block the artery for 30 minutes and operate on it. What he had to do was to cool her body down to about 50 degrees. So she was in suspended animation. Then to stop her heart so that the blood wasn't flowing anymore. Then to drain the blood out of her brain so he could see the inside of the artery. And then open the artery and rebuild it. And close it and then start her heart again and warm her body back up and just reverse the process. So it was a radical procedure. She agreed to it. Dr. Spetzler is very well known in neurosurgical circles. He's a masterful neurosurgeon, and he's willing to do high-risk things that usually work out very well because he's really good. So he did the surgery in 1991. And after the surgery, he was talking to her in the recovery room. The surgery went very well, no problems. And she reported that she saw the whole operation, that when her heart stopped, what they did, they put her under the surgical drapes. They put brain monitors on her so they could confirm that her brain was not functioning. And it's probably the best monitored near-death experience in human history because everything was monitored. So whereas a lot of near-death experiences are just, you know, somebody's heart stops in the middle of nowhere and you're desperately trying to save them. In this case, it was all done very, very precisely and it was all planned.
Yeah, so usually near-death experiences are not orchestrated.
Yes.
That's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to plan for, but in the case of Pam Reynolds, they did. They knew that she was going to go through the conditions that gave you a near-death experience. That's interesting.
Well, in fact, they killed her, meaning that, and they had to have the documentation that her brain had no function, because when they cut off because they had to prove that her body temperature was low enough that she could live through having no brain function. So it all had to be documented and proven to make it safe. So she told him that she watched the operation. And she said, as soon as her heart stopped, she recalls hearing like a sound like a natural D. She was a musician, so she knew the sounds of musical notes. And she said, then she felt a pop, and she was outside of her body, looking down at her body. And then she said she felt like she was floating to the ceiling of the operating room, and she could see everything. And she said her vision was beautiful. Like she could see details, the colors were gorgeous. She felt sorry for her body. She said she had this little, sort of shriveled little body there. And she was kind of happy to be out of it. And she watched the surgery. She watched all the instruments. She listened to the conversations in the operating room. She listened to the music that was playing in the operating room. So Spetzler kind of wasn't sure what to make of this until she told him the conversations that he had and the people he was having them with and the names of the songs that were playing on the radio, etc. And this was all when she was documented to have zero brain function at all. Then she said that she saw a tunnel and she felt herself being pulled into the tunnel went down the tunnel, and on the other side of the tunnel was this incredibly beautiful world. She said the colors were just unbelievable. She said it was beyond description how beautiful this place was. And she encountered her grandmother and her uncle, if not mistaken, who had predeceased her by many years. And she had a conversation with them. They were very happy to see her. But they said, it's not your time. You have to go back. And she was reluctant to go back. She was, it was so pretty there. She didn't really want to leave. So she goes back down the tunnel, and then she pops back into her body, and she said it was like jumping into ice water.
Wow.
Which is true, because her body temperature was 50 degrees. The thing she described, including detailed descriptions of the instruments that Spetzler was using, that a person who wasn't acquainted with neurosurgery, who wasn't in the operating room during a neurosurgical operation, wouldn't know. These are special instruments. So her near-death experience is probably the best documented. It was a fascinating experience. She wrote a book about it, and she actually recently passed away for good. But she spent the rest of her life telling people about what she experienced.
How long did she live after the operation? Do you have any idea?
She died. I believe she was 60-ish, and died of heart failure recently. But the operation was in 1991, and she only recently passed away. It was a year or two ago.
Wow! So it was total success, it sounds like.
Oh, she did beautifully. She did beautifully. It was an amazing operation. Dr. Spetzler is really he's sort of the maven of aneurysm surgery. Actually, I think he just retired, but people would go to Phoenix to train in aneurysm surgery with him. He was a brilliant surgeon.
That's wonderful. You know, I'm a fan of John Burke, who wrote the book, I believe it was called Imagine Heaven. And you know why I like him, Michael? Because he had a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. So, well, then he must be good.
Then but he's got to be good.
He's got to be good. That's right. And then he went into the ministry and he wrote a book, Imagine Heaven. But what is really interesting is to go to the YouTube channel where John Burke interviews some people with near-death experiences. And it's one thing to talk about near-death experiences like we do. It's another one to hear people talk about their near-death experiences. You have no doubt in your mind that they really experienced this.
Oh, yeah.
And it's real. I read that some people say, well, it's kind of like a dream. Well, dreams are something which, I don't know about you, but I have a dream and I say, oh, that's interesting. And then 5 seconds later, I'm brushing my teeth and I forget what I dreamed about.
Right.
You know, they kind of evaporate. But I think it was 96% of the people interviewed said that they thought it was real.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really astonishing.
There are many characteristics of near-death experiences that are quite unique to those experiences and demonstrate that there are no sort of simple kind of materialist explanations for them. If you have a dream, or you have a hallucination, or you have brain dysfunction because of hypoxia or dying brain, all of those things have very characteristic mental states. Usually they're very confusing. It's often hard to remember what happened. It's kind of a panic kind of feeling, or they're hazy and fuzzy and so on. But near-death experiences are almost invariably the exact opposite of that. They're very coherent. They're very clear. People describe them as being more real than reality.
Yes.
That is that you realize that the way you're living now is kind of not all that real. The real thing is on the other side. And it's completely unlike hallucinations, hypoxia, all of that. The other thing is, and this fascinates me, this I think is one of those bits of evidence that is so powerful, but doesn't come across as powerful until you think about it. There are thousands of reports of near-death experiences, and many of them involve going down a tunnel, and at the other end of the tunnel, you meet people. You meet people, friends, relatives.
Yes.
There has never been a report that I know of a person on the other side of the tunnel being a living person.
That is astonishing. I read the book Heaven is for Real by, I think it was a story about a little boy that had the near-death experience, and his name was Colin Burpo. And he visited the front porch of heaven, and after he recovered, he told his mom, I never knew I had a sister.
Right, right.
And I forget it was if it was an abortion or a miscarriage, but the mother just you know, cried. And they actually gave her a name. I believe it was a miscarriage mm-hmm. because they gave the baby a name. And she said, yeah, I am. And I forget the name, but she said, I am. Yeah, I am your sister.
Well, there are analogous reports. There's one that utterly fascinated me. It was Catherine Kubler-Ross, who was a Swiss psychiatrist who wrote extensively on the psychology of death and dying.
Uh-huh.
She worked as a psychiatrist in a hospital. And one of her jobs was when people would come into the emergency room seriously injured, she would go down and counsel them and kind of help them with the emotional stress of being so badly hurt. And there was a little girl that she saw that she wrote about who had been in a car accident. Her whole family had been in the car and she'd had a car accident. And she had a near-death experience at the scene and she was resuscitated. So Kubler-Ross was fascinated by this and asked her what she experienced. And she said that she had gone down this tunnel, and on the other side of the tunnel was this beautiful place that looked like heaven and all of that. And she saw her brother there and talked with her brother, who told her that he was there, but it wasn't her time yet, and she had to come back. And her brother had been taken to a different hospital after the accident. The family, different people in the family were taken to different hospitals, and the brother had died at the hospital, and she didn't know it.
Well. Wow.
So she didn't know he was dead, but she saw him there. There's another famous report of a young girl who, a young woman who had a near-death experience with some kind of surgical mishap. When she was resuscitated, she told her family that she had met her sister at the other end of the tunnel. And her family then just got a call at around this time from police in a different state where her sister was going to college that her sister had just been killed in a car accident.
That is really fascinating. You know, one of the things, when I first heard about near-death experiences, I was very skeptical. But when you have a lot of anecdotes, those anecdotes begin to add up and
right.
you get evidence.
Right.
And that's what we have. And we have lots of evidence that indeed this happened. But there's people that climb on. In fact, I had a one of my colleagues says, no, that, you know, that Colin Burpo thing, that isn't true. He admitted later that he never experienced that. And I thought, wow, this is interesting. Maybe this kid was trying to hop on and get a bunch of publicity and make money. Well, I did some study, and there was another case of a boy whose parents wrote a book called The Boy That Went to Heaven. And they were saying that this little boy had Colin Burpo sort of experiences, and they were trying to climb on the bandwagon, and the little boy grew up, and he said, no, this was totally fake. But you don't hear that very much.
Right,
and,
right.
And that's the beauty of it. One of the things which let's talk about Colin Burpo again. He came back and he says, yeah, I saw Granddad. And I thought this was a fascinating story. He says, you saw Granddad in heaven? You know, his grandfather had passed away, and he said, yes. And they showed him all sorts of pictures, and he said, nah, that's not him. That's not him. And they finally got to a picture where his grandfather was a young man.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, that's Granddad.
Yeah, right.
I thought that was so cool.
Yes,
That gives me hope that when I regenerate that I'm going to have my young body again,
well,
which is going to be.
I have the same feeling. I mean, I definitely want to go to heaven, but I'd rather not have the sore knees, you know. It'd be kind of nice, you know, so it'd be great.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But the other thing that people come back from near-death experiences, most of them are not afraid to die anymore.
Right.
My wife's grandfather had a near-death experience. He was no longer afraid of death.
Yeah.
Because it was so beautiful. And I think you mentioned earlier that this Pam Reynolds really was reluctant to come back.
Oh, yeah, right. Most people don't want to come back. It's a much better side of the tunnel, actually, over there. And these experiences are generally life-changing.
Yes.
It's worthwhile noting that not all near-death experiences are pleasant. First of all, not all near-death experiences are reported. That is, and there have been people who have studied this rather carefully. Many people who have near-death experiences consider them to be such powerful, intimate things that they don't tell anyone.
Yes.
Because it's too personal, or because they're afraid they'll be made fun of, something, but they just keep it to themselves. And there are a number of reports of hellish near-death experiences. And there's a guy named Howard Storm, who was an atheist. He was a very accomplished artist, but a very convinced atheist, who had a near-death experience a number of years ago. And he had an intra-abdominal catastrophe. He had a burst duodenal ulcer. And he was awaiting emergency surgery in his room. But he was near death. I don't know that he actually coded, but he was near death. And he said that he heard voices in the hallway outside his room. And in this experience, he got up and walked outside of his room. And there were these sort of humanoid beings outside of the room who kept coaxing him to follow them. And initially, they seemed rather nice. They seemed rather, they seemed like they were friendly. But as he followed them down the hallway, they became nasty. They became demanding, and they actually began to take pieces of his body and just kind of rip them away. And he became terrified. And then he heard a voice saying, "Well, pray, just pray." So he initially wouldn't do it. He said, "I'm an atheist. I don't pray." And the voice just kept saying, "Pray." So finally, he started praying, and he saw a distant light that soon became a very bright light, and hands came out of the light, embraced him, and he went to heaven and got to see what heaven was like. And then he came back into his body and went into the operating room, had the ulcer fixed. He made a recovery. He became a Christian minister and has told the story many times. He wrote a book called My Descent into Death. And it's a great book, but a lot of people have had hellish experiences, so it's not all light.
You know, I sent you a clip of his interview, and it's one thing to hear about it, but to listen to him recount it, and the way that you see the horror in his eyes, and the horror in relating his experience, and he begins to cry that it was such a terrible experience. He said that he had experiences which. He says, you know, there's some things they did to me I've never shared with anybody because they're so reprehensible.
Yes.
And just astonishing. I'll try to remember to put a link to that in the podcast notes if people want to watch it. Because if you want to watch something that really chills you about the reality of hell, you listen to his episode.
And he broke down crying in the video, even many years later. I mean, it was obviously a terrifying experience.
Yeah. One of the things I read a book called After by a guy named Bruce Grayson.
Yeah.
And he was a psychiatrist, and he spent his life studying near-death experiences. And he recounts cases of people waking up who had near-death experiences, and they woke up and they said, "Don't let me die." And then they went back into their state, and they came out again during the operation. It's probably a long operation, I suppose. And they said, "Don't let me die." And then when the people recovered, they said, "What were you experiencing? What was going through your mind?" And they didn't remember.
Right.
In other words, they totally blanked it out because it was so terrible.
Right.
So I wonder if there's a lot of these hellish experiences that people just blank out.
Well, there could be. Yes, definitely. And people just don't want to remember it. The other issue is, though, that we do know just biologically that the brain is very much necessary for the ordinary formation of memories. So that it may very well be that, because one question people have asked, which is a sensible question, is if near-death experiences are real, then why doesn't everyone who dies and is resuscitated have a near-death experience? And not everyone does.
Yes.
And so one of the explanations, which rings true for me, is that you have to remember it. And for example, I've been under anesthesia myself as a patient on several occasions for various operations. And when I wake up from anesthesia, I always have a powerful feeling that I had a lot of experiences when I was under anesthesia, but I cannot recall what they are.
It was like one of those dreams where you think about it later and it just evaporates.
Yeah. Like you know a lot of stuff happened, but your memory is just blank for that. But you know that something happened. So I suspect that memory is dependent upon certain physiological things, and it may not work for everyone. Another very important aspect of near-death experiences is not simply their reality. And I think that the science of them, in my view, is very clear that there is a reality at the core of this. Exactly what that reality is, exactly what we can be sure of, and what et cetera, that's a different question. But there's no question, I think, that there is something real about these near-death experiences, and they do represent experiences that are outside of the realm of mortal life. But a fascinating aspect of near-death experiences is also it reveals the bizarre extremes that atheists and materialists will go to deny reality and to deny science. That is, that all of the excuses that materialists and atheists made, for example, Carl Sagan argued emphatically that the tunnel experience of near-death experiences are a memory of the birth canal.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And he was even made fun of by other atheists because of that one. Because number one, babies don't form memories like that at that time. Number two, babies almost always, when they're born through a normal delivery, present with the back of their head first, so they never see the birth canal. Number three, it's not a pleasant experience if one has ever watched a birth. The babies come out screaming. It's there's no heaven on the other side of that tunnel.
Yeah.
And it's just a silly theory that, but the people, materialists have said it's all wishful thinking, it's all just hallucinations, it's all dream states. There's even a Darwinian evolution excuse that some materialists have given that I think the reasoning was that having a near-death experience makes you more relaxed in dangerous situations going forward because you don't fear death as much, and that makes it gives you a better chance for surviving. I mean, all kinds of garbage.
So how could that have happened with evolution, right?
Right, yeah. Right.
You think about that. How do you acquire that that characteristic? It's just ridiculous to think about it from an evolutionary point of view.
But if it's ridiculous to think about it, some of them have thought about it. that doesn't stop them.
So I'm a big believer in Pascal's statement that there's a God-shaped vacuum inside all of us, and everybody has to fill it, and that includes the atheist.
Sure.
So they make up their own religion.
Oh, yeah.
I know in artificial intelligence, they think, well, they can achieve immortality by uploading themselves. And, you know, we know, as Christians, we've known about immortality for a long time.
Sure.
But yeah, everybody's trying to do that. By the way, I had a talk with a guy named Tononi, which sure. Both you and I know. And I brought up the idea of near-death experiences. And I said, this is what happens. He says, yeah, I've read about it. He's an atheist, or at least a materialist. And he said, you know, I can make somebody have a near-death experience the equivalent by slipping them some LSD or some peyote mushrooms. So I bought up, and I didn't know the word at the time, but I talked about these vertical near-death experiences where you could corroborate what was happening. And he changed the subject, and we never returned to it.
Yeah.
So it is interesting that everybody has their own take on it, and the materialists have built themselves a silo, and everything that exists has to fit inside that silo.
Well, the people who deny near-death experiences have come up with all kinds of physiological and biochemical explanations of, you know, effects of anesthetics, a temporal lobe seizure, hypoxia, hypercarbia, where you get too much carbon dioxide in your blood, endorphins, you know, ketamine. There's a million different theories. And what people who make up these theories, and they're really just fabricated theories, they're not really to be taken seriously, but people who make them up, invariably what they do is they'll pick one narrow aspect of the experience.
Right.
And then try to find an analogy to some other state where you have too much endorphins or you have a temporal lobe seizure. But, and even then, it's not a very good explanation. But the near-death experience has to be explained in its totality. And the totality, nothing fits except that it's real. That fits.
Yeah, that's certainly the reduction to the best explanation, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I passionately believe that the near-death experiences tell us enormous things about the truth of our earthly existence, the truth of our immortal souls, the truth of what life will be like after we pass away. But it also tells us a great deal about the resourcefulness of materialists and of atheists, and there because if it were not for ideological bias, no materialist explanation for near-death experiences would ever be taken seriously in the scientific community. I mean, there's so many of these experiences, and although we don't have the randomized prospective controlled studies on this, there will never be a randomized prospective controlled study on near death, because that would be a pretty illegal experiment to do. But the simple number and volume and clarity of these experiences speak to their reality, and people who deny them are doing so really for ideological reasons.
You know, in scripture, God at one time described himself as I am. I think we only have just a glimpse of what God is about. I mean, I think from both science and scripture, God exists outside of time and space. I cannot comprehend that. I cannot comprehend no space. I can't comprehend no time. So he was asked, who are you? And he said, I am. Right. What a great explanation. And a lot of people that come back from the near-death experiences say that they have experienced things which they just don't have the ability to relate.
Precisely.
That they have experienced, they saw different colors, they saw different phenomena, which they just don't have the explanation to, they just don't have an explanation for. So it reminds me of going up to somebody that's been blind since birth and trying to explain them what seeing is like. That would be really difficult. And I think that's what these near-death experience people are doing. It's not seeing, but it's the experience that they had in the near-death experiences that they just can't come back and they just can't explain it. It's beyond explanation. And that is, I think, the truth of God's glory beyond our comprehension. You know, this Absolutely. Idea of I am. What a phenomenal way to describe God.
Well, there's you mentioned the blind thing, which just brings up another point, which is absolutely fascinating, is that there are people. There are a number of reports of this of people who've been born blind from birth, have never had vision, who have a near-death experience where they see and it can be checked what they saw. They report seeing things, and the things they see are things in the world that can be confirmed. The other fascinating aspect of this, there is a book called Otherworld Journeys. Carol Zaleski actually is the author, which is a fascinating book, a wonderful book. Carol Zaleski is an English professor. It's an East Coast college. I forgot which college.
And what's the name of the book again?
Otherworld Journeys, O-T-H-E-R, World Journeys. And it's a wonderful book. And what she did was she went back and studied historically, going back thousands of years, all of these mystical experiences, which she includes near-death experiences in that discussion. And I believe she also includes UFOs and things like that, all these weird things that people have described. And she points out that there are these threads that run through it, that these, and she calls them otherworld journeys, in different cultures and different in different eras and different years, they have similar themes. And it's like people really are seeing things that they don't have words for. And she said what tends to happen is that when a person has an experience like this, when they're in that other world, there are no words for it. So when they come back to this world, they choose the words from this world that best explain what they saw, but it's never precise. So there tends to be like people nowadays might describe seeing a machine. Whereas people thousands of years ago would see something else. It just depends on what's culturally something that you're capable of drawing an analogy with. So it's a fascinating book. But the other thing that I think is very important in understanding near-death experiences in context is that if you look back at, or even look not just back, but modern day, people who like monks, people who do contemplative prayer, people who do very deep prayer where they get much closer to God in their prayer, or even unite with God in their prayer, that St. John of the Cross wrote about. And a prerequisite for getting close to God is what St. John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul. And what he meant by the dark night of the soul is that in order to see the other world, in order to see eternity and to see God, you have to get your own thoughts out of the way. That is, your own thoughts interfere with this sort of deeper sight. And what a mystic or a monk or a nun who's doing contemplative prayer has to do is suppress their own mind. And that suppression of one's own mind and God helping you with that is what St. John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul. It's kind of a darkness, but on the other side of the darkness is a union with God. And if you think about it, a near-death experience is kind of a medical analogy of a dark night of the soul. That is, your brain gets suppressed, your thoughts are no longer interfering, and now you're seeing the other world. You're seeing the other side of things. So I think that's fascinating. I think near-death experiences have a close parallel to mystical experiences that many very deeply religious people have had.
Fascinating. I wanted to talk about the idea that some of these people go to heaven with the front porch of heaven, if you will, with their near-death experiences, and they meet God, they meet Jesus, they meet the God of the Bible. One of them was a pilot. I forget what his name was, but he was interviewed in the John Burke series, and he said, yeah, I looked up and there was Jesus. And the gentleman that went to hell, he was confronted by Jesus also. What do we do with people who have experienced near-death experiences that have a different culture, a different religion? I read in Grayson's book, for example, one guy came back and he says, yeah, I saw a guy with big white hair and a long beard, and I thought it was Gandalf from Lord of the Rings. I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, it's very, very interesting. It leads us into a very interesting discussion about what is the religious perspective on this. You know, we've been talking about the science, but and there are many theologians who really say you have to be careful about this stuff. You don't know exactly what is being experienced. Is this a demonic delusion? You know, who's running the show? Exactly what are you seeing? And I think that's a fair point, that it's very hard to draw profound theological implications from these things. However, I think Carol Zaleski's insight, I think it's a beautiful insight, that you see things on the other side and you see things in a context that doesn't have words. Like it's something that's ineffable. You can't describe it clearly. When you come back to this life, you use the best words you have. So if you are Muslim, you know, you see Allah. If you are a Christian, you see Jesus or God. If you're a Jew, you may see Abraham or Yahweh. If you are a Lord of the Rings fan, you may see Gandalf. If you're from Hollywood, you may see yourself.
That's good.
I think everyone who takes near-death experiences seriously, theologians included, I think would agree that, and to use the term that you use, that you're really just on the front porch. That is, that you really haven't entered heaven. You've just got a glimpse of the outskirts. So when somebody goes up there and they see someone that we wouldn't expect, if you see Gandalf, well, when you really die, you go much deeper into it, and you realize that, well, maybe that wasn't Gandalf, maybe it was somebody else. The theological implications are very, very deep, and I think it's very hard to draw theological implications from these experiences. I think the best thing you can draw from them is that something really, really powerful happens to these people that is outside of mortal life. That's clear.
Very good. I wonder if you could comment as a neurosurgeon, what's the state of the brain during these near-death experiences? Is the brain totally dead? And how do you figure out that the brain is dead, not functioning, if you will?
Yeah, it's a good question. Most of the time, you can't be as sure about it as you'd like to be because, again, it's a hectic, unplanned event where people are not particularly interested in monitoring the brain. They're interested in getting your heart beating again. But Pam Reynolds' experience was pretty good, meaning that she was absolutely certified with no brain activity. They're measuring brain waves. They're even stimulating her brain stem with very loud clicks in earphones around her ears to make sure that even her brainstem was completely non-functional. And to do the surgery, not only was her heart stopped, but Spetzler drained all the blood out of her brain. So it doesn't get any more than that. You know, that's pretty clear. There's much that we don't know about the neuroscientific effects on the brain and the dying process. The brain can be without oxygen for between 4 to 6 minutes before injury becomes permanent, and the brain can be without oxygen only for about 8 minutes or so before brain death occurs. And brain death, when you use that term, is usually just meant to mean biological final death, meaning it's dead. So near-death experiences are near brain death, but probably not to that point. But what is known, and I think we see this clinically all the time, is that experiences that people have because of a dysfunctioning brain, that is because oxygen is cut off, because carbon dioxide is too high, because of things like that, are almost invariably very upsetting experiences. They are panicked. They are vague. They are not clear. They're not the kind of thing you want to remember. And near-death experiences are a completely different thing. They're a beautiful, usually beautiful, profound experience that you remember forever and changes your life. And that is not at all what happens when the brain is damaged, say, for example, from lack of oxygen.
So what would you say to somebody like Tononi that said it's just LSD or peyote mushrooms or something like that?
I would tell him that he doesn't have the slightest understanding of near-death experiences. As I said, what people do, what materialists and atheists do when they attempt to explain away near-death experiences, and none of them attempt to explain them, they just attempt to explain them away, what they invariably do is they take a superficial narrow slice of the whole experience and try to make up some hand-waving analogy between that and some physiological process. But if you're going to explain near-death experiences, you need to come equipped with an explanation that explains the totality of the experience. And none of them even come close to that.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Well, Michael, this has been just a fascinating discussion. Any last things you want to add? What would be your takeaway for people that are listening about near-death experiences and what that should mean to them?
My takeaway from it is that near-death experiences strongly suggest, well, first of all, that there's powerful reason to believe that they are real. They have been the object of scientific study now for decades, and the evidence is quite strong. They're very, very well-confirmed near-death experiences where no one who looks at the evidence objectively would ever deny that these are real supernatural events. And as far as what they mean for our lives, I think is very important. And what's very important about it is that it is further evidence that we have immortal souls. That we do not cease to exist at death, and that the life we live now is a preparation for life that goes on and I think is eternal. And that it's important that we live the lives we live now, recognizing that this is on the doorstep of eternity, and we want to live our lives in such a way that eternity is a time of joy and a time of reunion with God. And that this is real, that what the great faiths have been teaching us for thousands of years has a powerful core of reality.
Wow. Well, that reminds me of I believe it's the Apostle Paul said, "Oh, death, where is thy sting?" I think that for people that might be afraid of dying, that the near-death experience story has to be nothing but comforting, just wonderfully so.
And it's particularly salient, particularly important to keep in mind, as you had pointed out earlier in our discussion, that people who've had near-death experiences, one of the hallmarks of that is that they lose their fear of death.
Yes.
That is, that once you understand what it is, death is no longer something to be afraid of, but something to be joyfully welcomed.
Wow. Well, thank you, Michael. We've been talking to Dr. Michael Ignor, and this is a continuation of a number of podcasts that we've had with him. But today's topic has been the fascinating concept of near-death experiences. And we've been talking about free will, the soul, consciousness, and near-death experiences. These are not just abstract ideas. They're really what makes us human. And Dr. Ignor reminds us that the deepest truths may lie outside of the lab, outside of science, outside of materialism. And indeed, that's where it lives. So until next time on Mind Matters News, stay thoughtful, stay in contact with God, and be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.